On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we dig into Paul Skenes' recent struggles. Sure, his ERA still looks pretty good, but the Pirates have lost 9 straight Skenes starts, and he got crushed against the Phillies the other day. We talk about the defense failing him. The Pirates, amidst this weird season where they are raking and their pitching has disappointed, where they go from here. Then we talk about the New York Mets. Of course, we talk about the New York Mets. We're not the only ones talking about the Mets on a baseball podcast. And then, of course, it's Friday. So we give you the good, the bad, the ugly. And oh boy, is it a good one. All that and more on this Friday edition of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world pissed off that America 250 is overshadowing Vinny Castilla's birthday. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And if we as a country can't come together to celebrate a legendary Colorado Rocky, then maybe the American experiment truly is too far gone.
Yeah, he's not the only Rockies legend celebrating a birthday on Saturday, July 4th. Juan Mejia, a reliever who I believe, I'm just calling my shot right now, he will be traded. Some team is going to call up Josh Burns and
happy birthday, America.
Paul DePodesta. Sorry, I was blanking on his name for a second. And they're going to say, hey, this guy's throwing really hard. We think we can do better than him with his 6.28 ERA. We think he's better than that. And Josh Burns and Paul DePodesta, the new Rockies front office, they'll be like, yeah, you know what? That's fine. You go for it.
On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, no more Rockies trade scenarios.
That's it.
We promise.
That's it.
We swear. That's it.
We got Skenes scenarios.
We got Steve Cohen, Mets owner. Ooh. We got all-star voting. And of course, we got the good, bad, ugly. But let's start with a little bit of panic to soothe the soul. That's our opener. Is Paul Skenes unk? That's what people are saying. The Gen Z Pirates ace has been mid since the beginning of May. He has 0 wins. Pitcher wins, are they silly? Yes. Are they somewhat instructive? Yes. He doesn't have a win since May 12th, which was, I believe, the first game of the World Cup. Feels like that's been going on forever. And over those 9 starts since May 12th, he has a 5.36 earned run average across 47 innings. 15 walks and 63 strikeouts. Those are nice numbers. The problem for Skenes has been the long ball. He's allowed 7 homers over that span. He has now allowed 11 this entire season. He allowed 11 all of last season. That is certainly something to be worried about. Paul Skenes, one of the most important players, best pitchers in our sport. The reigning National League Cy Young, a crucial character in this Pittsburgh Pirates season. Jordan, on the scale of tranquility to total chaos, where are you at with Skenes' struggles?
Let's kind of work towards answering that question together, because as we evaluate how this has gone, I mean, I'm thinking about Skenes' season in really 3 parts. Part one is opening day. And just opening day. Opening day, and not just opening day, if I'm not mistaken, I know we had the stupid Giants-Yankees the night before, but on opening day proper, I believe this was the first game of the day, if I'm not mistaken.
It was.
It was. Okay. So now I know the Mets were home, so it was not technically the first half inning, but the first inning really of the season that we were all watching was an O'Neill Cruz, some Paul Skenes, but mostly Pirates defense catastrophe. He allows 5 earned runs. How earned were they? Who's to say? But the point is, he did not finish the first inning, right? He throws, 37 pitches and is pulled before the end of the first inning. And so at that point, it's just like, oh my God, Paul Skenes is going to have to dig his way out of this hole that is or isn't his fault that literally happened in the first inning of the entire season for all of us. Part two is Paul Skenes doing exactly that. Over his next 8 starts, he is incredible because he is Paul Skenes, and that is what he does. He allows one or zero runs in seven of those eight starts. He lowers his ERA all the way back down to the number that we are also accustomed to, starting with a 1.98. Everyone was making their jokes that, oh, he's slacking because he had a 1.96 in 2024 and a 1.97 in 2025.
Now he'll have a 5 ERA by the time we all die. No. It came much quicker than that because I imagine
2026.
Mm-hmm. Number three, Jordan, was his last nine starts where he has struggled quite more than he usually does.
Yeah. However, and you lay that out right, it's not just that he does not have a pitcher win over those last nine starts. It's that the Pirates do not have a win-win over those last nine starts. Skeens has not. The reason this is really elevated to, oh my God, is there something wrong with him, is he just had a real clunker the other day against the Phillies, where he allowed 8 runs, 7 earned. Before that, I mean, he went, you know, 6 innings, 2 earned, 6 innings, 2 earned, 6 innings, 3 runs, 1 earned. 4 and 2/3, 3 innings, 1 earned. It's not like he has been getting shelled. That ERA is inflated a little bit by this most recent outing and a little bit back in May when he allowed 5 and 4 in those first two starts in the stretch. But the walks, the homers, everything just looks a little bit off. And the fact that the Pirates aren't winning in now almost 2 months with him taking the mound. And because the stuff, we can invite this when we talk about how much we're panicking, the stuff just looks a little bit less crisp. And I want to mention the velocity here because that's something that even when he was dealing earlier on in the season, we did sort of notice. We said, okay, this guy's not throwing 100 anymore. He's just chilling at 97, 98. And we just assumed, and I think that that was fair, that that was entirely on purpose. And that might still be the case still with what we're seeing recently. But now it's dropped off to closer to 95, 96, 97 more than 97, 98, 99. And he's just become more hittable. So with all that in mind, I mean, yeah, where are you at as you've watched him? You've seen him in person, I guess, during this stretch against the Dodgers. But that wasn't that bad of an outing, if I recall.
He was good. My panic level in the long run with Paul Skeens is so minimal. And I would say my panic level in the medium term is also pretty minimal because this level of athlete with this level of drive and this level of focus and this level of intelligence is going to figure out how to get outs. And so as much as you can believe in a pitcher, I believe in Paul Skeens getting back on track. He will make the All-Star game in a couple weeks. Whether he deserves it or not, we'll talk about that. It will not be Paul Skeens' final All-Star game, right? Like, I feel very firmly about that. I do think, however, that his struggles raise a couple of very interesting conversations, one about his fastball specifically, and another about the Pirates and the way that they're constructed. And I'd like to begin with the fastball, if that's all right. So, coming out of college, when Skeens was the number one pick at LSU, I would say the biggest knock on him was his fastball shape. Now, what does that mean? What does fastball shape mean? So when we evaluate really any pitch, how the pitch looks to a hitter is actually more important than how it moves or how fast it's going. It is all about perception. And Skeens is like the shape on his fastball, the way that it rode, the way that it moved was, I would say, suboptimal for a number one overall pick. He was more reliant on his elite velocity than the shape of the fastball, but a variety of other reasons, his extension, his command, his deception, allowed that fastball to kind of play up beyond its shape. But I would say, Jordan, do you agree, besides the fact that he was just simply a pitcher, the shape was kind of the biggest knock on him coming out of the draft?
Yeah, I think that's fair. He did not have the kind of pitch with the carry while he had the velo, modern fastball that is considered more valuable when it has a little bit more ride at the top of the zone. His was not Spencer Strider, a true sinker, but yeah.
Think every Mariners pitcher effect, essentially, you know.
Most of
not
them,
everyone,
yeah.
But yeah. You get my point. Okay, so that is something to consider. And so then Skeens comes up and he's dominant for the first, you know, year and a half, 2 years of his career. And coming into this year, he was open. This is an article from Noah Hiles at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. kind of about how, you know, he notes that Skeens was kind of intentional about dialing back the velocity a little bit this year. Now, whether that is true or Skeens is just covering, I can't speak to that. But it's interesting because it seems that he wanted to work deeper into games and throw more innings, and maybe turning the velocity down was a reason for that. But Noah notes that the fastball this season has been the main culprit, and that that is the pitch that is getting pummeled, particularly for the long ball, right? And it is a reminder that for all the wonderful things that Paul Skeens is and all the wonderful things he can do, he does not have great fastball shape. And so for it to be kind of operate at a more effective level, it needs to be either zooming in there in high 90s or be where he wants it to go. And I think at points over this recent run, his command has been a little bit off. And that mixed with the lower velocity is what has led to some of his struggles. We've talked about this a lot in terms of like Roky Sasaki and how he needs to have that fastball in the upper 90s or have the command to be successful. And in that way, Skeens is no different. He just has a variety of other pitches and skills that he can go to.
Yes.
Perhaps it is unfair to compare the two. But that, I think, is an important conversation when we talk about why Skeens has struggled here.
Well, I think that last point is something I wanted to bring up, and why it has been interesting that he's had these struggles relatively. Yes, a lot of the home runs have come on four-seamers, but if you do look at just the overall like batting line against his four-seamer, it's not that different this season. Now, maybe that's lopsided towards the beginning of the season, but if you look at the overall, you know, WOBA against, ex-WOBA against, hard hit rate against, like, all of that is in line. His sinker is getting hit a lot more. His splinker is getting hit a lot more. And his changeup also has a negative run value. So now him having all these
all
different
of
pitches
that,
with
though,
Roky, well, yeah,
that all comes off the fastball, right? And so like,
for sure,
even though
for
the
sure.
fastball itself, so think about it this way, right? If the heater is at 99, or not, let's just say 96, 97, 98, the hitter's got to be kind of geared up for that. If it's at 95, 96, they don't need to kind of cheat to it. And that's going to allow them to be more effective to the off-speed stuff. So I think those two things are certainly connected.
Especially when the sinker and the splinker in particular, like that's a pitch. And even the changeup in the high 80s, those are still hard pitches. But you can imagine that the splinker, if it's 94 or 93, is less effective if the four-seamer is 95, 96 than when it's 98, 99, right? So all those differentiate. That's why when pitchers are adding new offerings, they're often looking to have distinct velocity bands within them, right? You could have a bridge between different ones so that you're basically forcing, this is how you're really messing with hitters' timing on top of just the actual shapes and movement that you're creating. You're just giving hitters a lot to deal with. This is why you have a lot of, and this is what Skeens has had. He's not the only one, but having multiple fastballs that are moving in multiple different directions, these have all been benefits. But I do think, to your point, the velocity going down even a little bit has blended all those a little bit too close together that has made him maybe a little bit more hittable. Now, that said, let's hope that this is still a physical thing, that it's maybe it's a mechanical thing. He's just working through it, because, you know, when you do see a velocity fall off, now again, it's not like he's out there throwing 91, but when it's sustained for a while, when the spin rate goes down, there's definitely at least a little bit. Okay. So I don't want to get too freaked out there.
Sure.
But at the same time, let's open this back up even bigger, right?
Well, I want to bring in my second point. I want to bring in my second point about the Pirates now.
Right. That's what I'm
doing. Because the other major factor here is that the Pirates are bad at defense. And they have been particularly bad at defense, for whatever reason, when Paul Skeens is on the mound. You can go on Baseball Savant, a wonderful website, and you can effectively sort by team's fielding run value by pitcher on the mound, right? Mm-hmm. Paul Skeens, and so this is like a simplified way of saying, how good has a team's defense been for each pitcher? Paul Skeens has had the single worst defense by this metric of any pitcher in the National League. Last. Bottom. There are two American League pitchers who've gotten worse support. That's Kamar Rocker of the Texas Rangers and Jose Ferrer of the Seattle Mariners. And so, like, when you look at it through that lens, you can understand how there are more batted balls that are not turning into outs. And for Skeens, who has been open about pitching to contact a little bit more. Now, I know his strikeout rate, I believe, is up this year compared to previous seasons. But, like, he is someone who is not necessarily trying to blow it past you all the time. That, I think, was the case earlier on when he first came up. But he is sort of relying on the defense. And I think that, like, having a bad defense behind him is not a good mix for that. And I can imagine that, like, maybe I need to look at, like, the K rate over time. I can imagine if he's like, oh, wait, my defense sucks, I need to start striking guys out more, if that has been a part of this. Because when you look at the way that the Pirates are constructed, it's not a lot of Gold Glovers there. Brandon Lau has been really nice over at second base. That's been awesome. But besides that, you're not a lot of guys winning hardware.
Well, and this is what's so interesting, and I'm glad you bring up the defense, and of course, it's a big part of that opening day outing. But it's tied into, right, what's his goal? I think Paul Skeens wants to go out there and throw as many innings as possible. I mean, now he wants to go out there and throw a complete game. And he was doing that, right? The end of this stretch early on in the season when he was pitching really well, he goes eight scoreless on May 6th, eight scoreless on May 12th. He also has five consecutive starts there without walking anybody. And so that clearly the mindset was working. Now, since then, he's walked at least one batter in every game in all of those nine starts. And to your point, I do wonder if it's more of an approach thing where it's like, I do have to chase strikeouts more. Maybe I'm going to have deeper counts because I can't just throw it in there and hope that my defense behind me is going to get the job done so that I can get quick outs so that I can work deeper into games. And when it all goes bad, which is the combination of I am walking guys, I am allowing homers, and my defense sucks, that's what you get the other day in Philadelphia, where he only goes four innings, which was his shortest outing of the year besides the opening day catastrophe, right? So he's moving in the wrong direction in that regard. He hasn't gone more than six innings in any of these games. And, right, it's probably a combination of those things. It's not trusting the defense. It's going for strikeouts that maybe is leading to more walks. And then maybe it is just also a mechanical breakdown to the point where he's just not in the zone as much as he would like to be. So all of these things have conspired to put him in this position. He still has very good numbers on the season. He still has a strong case to be an all-star. But as I've mentioned many times about the best players in our sport on this podcast, when your standard is at the top, top, we get to judge you accordingly. And nobody has given us a standard above all the others, especially early in their career, more than Paul Skeens. So that's why this sample, regardless of the flukiness of them winning or not, is really interesting to evaluate. But I do think the last thing we need to talk about here is also just how it relates to the Pirates season, not just their defense and the team around him. But it's just so strange that here we are halfway through the season. The Pirates, I believe, are exactly 500. They were able to split that series in Philadelphia, and credit to them. But they reinvent their offense over the offseason successfully. They are number two in baseball in OPS, number three in runs, number nine in homers, seven in stolen bases, fourth in OBP. This is a good lineup. They are scoring runs. And the pitching is not awesome. I mean, there's parts of it that have been good. Braxton Ashcraft has an all-star case as well. The starting pitching on the whole has been above average, but the bullpen has been bad. The defense has been bad for the run prevention. And now somehow you've ended up in a situation where you're like, all right, is this pitching going to be good enough for the Pirates? And is Paul Skeens going to get his stuff together so that we think that we thought this was going to be the strength of the team? And instead, now the favorable view is, all right, great. Well, once the pitchers that are very talented and we're all excited about, if they can get back going, now this team could really be something to mess with. But the Pirates, unfortunately, as weird as the season has been, and we've said this before about a lot of teams, you really got to seize that before we give you the benefit of the doubt. And so far, it has been a very, very turbulent season in that regard.
And this is, let me seize on your word, seize, where the Pirates did not seize on the Paul Skeens opening provided to them a year ago, right? Where Skeens has this amazing rookie season. Then they go out in the winter and they don't really do anything. And it's just a reminder. And at the time, it's like, oh, well, you know, they have time. Like, Paul Skeens will be here forever. Well, that's not the case, particularly with pitchers. When you have a Skeens type and the window is open, you have to act because you never know. Do I think Skeens will be okay the rest of the year? Do I think the Pirates Like, do I think Skeens is going to be the reason the Pirates don't make the playoffs? No, I really don't believe that. However, I think it's now in play considering the struggles that he's had. And it is a reminder that you just got to go for it when you have the opportunity. I really do just want to harp on the defense, particularly like third base and shortstop. A ground ball to third base and shortstop to the left side of the infield is such a good outcome if you're a pitcher, right? The Pirates' third baseman, their main third baseman has been Nick Gonzalez, and their main shortstop has been Connor Griffin. Those two are their two worst infield defenders. The Pirates are fourth to last in baseball in converting ground balls to the left side into outs. Fourth worst, right? That's where, that's like a big part of this, right? Is those outcomes turning into base runners is part of the reason why Paul Skeens has struggled so much. That being said, he has clearly shown an ability to overcome bad defense before, and I do think he will be able to do it again. As far as him being an all-star, like, to me, it's a duh. We generally lean towards it's an exhibition. Does Braxton Ashcraft have better numbers? Yes. Are any people, would anybody be more excited to see Braxton Ashcraft than Paul Skeens? Braxton Ashcraft's family? And true ball knowers in the Pittsburgh area. And so if Skeens makes it over Ashcraft, which he probably will, I don't care. That's fine. Don't like it. Play better. Don't like it. Be more famous. You know, find a famous girlfriend, Braxton Ashcraft. And so as far as I'm concerned, this is all like relatively low panic meter for me.
Yeah. I'm like a, just a tick above that, but I'm mostly with you. And yeah, the Pirates are, what a weird, weird season this has been.
Do you know what's going to get Paul Skeens on the right track?
What?
This weekend, the Pirates are in D.C. for the 4th of July game, which is like an early game on Saturday. Will there be a flyover? Well, probably not, I guess, because D.C. airspace is weird.
He's also not pitching this weekend.
He's not pitching this weekend, but I think Paul Skeens in the nation's capital on July 4th, he can go see some planes, go over to Andrews Air Force Base, get in the cockpit, let your knees hit up against the dash, reset. Go to the Air and Space Museum. Paul Skeens. Paul. Ooh. Have you been to the Air and Space Museum, Paul Skeens? My guess is maybe, yes, no. Don't care. Go this weekend. You know what? I'm going to text Pirates PR and say, I got you. Send Skeens to Air and Space.
I support it. We will find out if he's an all-star.
It won't be that busy this weekend.
Well, never mind. I'm not making the joke I was going to make. Before we take a break, let me remind everybody the Yahoo Sports MLB YouTube channel is coming July 10th. That's a week from today. So keep an eye out when that launches. That is where you can find all things baseball. Barbacast, we're going to take a break. When we return, the New York Mets continue to give us stuff to talk about. All-star voting update and a little bit more on this Friday edition of Baseball Barbacast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. There is something Mets related that we need to talk about.
We aren't the only people with a podcast, believe it or not. In fact, we're not the only people with a baseball podcast. And we're going to talk about two other baseball podcasts that talked about the Mets. Friend of the program, Joel Sherman and John Heyman had Stevie Cohen, Uncle Stevie, Mets owner, on their pod this week, where Steve Cohen expressed frustration with the state of the New York Mets. There were a lot of interesting takeaways from Steve's conversation with John and Joel. Three old Jewish men sitting around talking about the Mets. Yep. Seen this before with my grandfather and his friends. Cohen was honest and expressed a level of frustration. Jordan, what were your takeaways from their conversation?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we've talked about how Steve Cohen has presented himself during these Mets times, most often referring to his timing and messaging on Twitter. If you recall the green shoots tweet where green the shoots. Mets were off to a horrible start and he was like, guys, don't worry, green shoots. There's actually some stuff going well, including things Steve like Bench Cohen's, got a solid. Remember, Bench got a solid hit.
Bench got a solid hit. He was right about that. He was right about Bench. He was all over Bench. His most recent tweet that was not a reply was on April 23rd. He said, that was a big boy moment for Bo. Great to see. Don't even remember what the big boy moment for Bo was. More recently, Steve Cohen has been replying to some, you know, anti-Semitism thrown his way, which I guess, you know, good for him. He should be doing that. But besides that, he's been pretty silent. And so that's why him going on John and Joel felt relevant, because we really haven't heard Steve address the state of his decrepit baseball team. I think the most interesting takeaway was a show of support from Steve Cohen towards beleaguered president of baseball operaciones, Mr. David Stearns. David Stearns,
much maligned.
Built much maligned on the hot seat no more, David Stearns. Quote, we'll figure out what changes need to be made, but it won't be David. That's what Goliath said. Sorry.
It's also what David said about Carlos Mendoza. Like a month
it
ago.
Is what David said about Carlos Mendoza.
So I do. I think that this is important. I'm not saying that this is not nothing, because Steve Cohen was very honest in this podcast appearance and was not. He was not necessarily painting a rosy picture, right? He has multiple times throughout
he
this
said,
thing, I am
straight
worried.
Up, I'm worried about 2027. I'm worried.
I am very worried. And not about whether they're going to play. He's worried about their own team. He's worried about how are we going to look, because the contract situations, he was like, oh my God, our payroll based on the opt-outs is already at $300 million. And look what's going on. Our farm system has stagnated, he said. And he said, I mean, he was not holding back in acknowledging the problems that have happened. It's not just the record. He goes into more specifics about where the payroll is at and just the status of these contracts and the fact that some of the players they just signed have not played and the fact that some of their prospects have not taken the step forward. Some of them have shown up. He mentions McLean and Wright, Bench and Ewing and whatnot. So it's an interesting
Bench
contrast.
Bench got a solid hit, right?
Bench did get a solid hit on April 15th. I can't believe that wasn't enough to turn the season around.
Solid.
I think that was what was interesting about this, is that he explains a lot of things that sound like reasons why David Stearns should be concerned about his job. And then he's like, but he's not going anywhere. I think that part of me is like, that makes sense, because I imagine if anything, Steve Cohen is just like, I don't want to have to deal with going to get a new president of baseball operations again. And he clearly thought Stearns was the guy, still is the guy. But I'll throw it back to you. Okay, so what other changes? I mean, we know that the coaching staff is going to be an interesting conversation for the rest of the season. What happens with Andy Green? He doesn't seem like someone we're expecting to be there in that position long term. They just hired a bunch of new coaches, including some we know quite well, right? How much more can you change this roster when you are in these contractual situations with some of these guys and also some of them who are already leaving? So it's like, yeah. All right, what are these changes going to be? And clearly saying, all right, David, we're going to keep letting you cook.
I am fascinated about that as well, because it's difficult to see what changes could be made. I think that it is in regards to player personnel. Steve Cohen, under the current system, can eat as much money as he wants. That might not be the case moving forward. I would be fascinated if at this deadline they try and get out from some of this money. They try and move Jorge Polanco. They try and move a guy like Bo Bichette. I don't think they will. I don't think they can. But it'll be interesting to see if that's the approach they take. Because they're going to sell at the deadline, right? And when they sell at the deadline, is the priority going to be to clear space off the big league roster to give Stearns more flexibility in the winter to fix his own mistakes? Or is the priority going to be acquiring top prospects, as you know, the best prospects they possibly can? Because for the 2027 team to look different than the 2026 team, stuff's got to happen. Peralta will probably be gone. I would think that Bichette is going to opt in. He's just got too much money left on that deal. Luis Robert's option probably won't get picked up, and he'll go to free agency.
I would be shocked. Yeah.
Polanco has another year. Manaea has another year, right? Like, how they go about trying to shed that money is interesting to me. On the main, like, I think that backing Stearns is the right move. He is as good of an option as there is available. He has failed miserably so far during his time in New York. It has been one of the more shocking disappointments that I can remember from a baseball operations perspective, because what he built in Milwaukee was so sustainable and impressive, and his fingerprints are still on that operation. And we just assumed that it would be like an Andrew Friedman situation, right? Very smart executive, goes from small market to big market and levels up. It did take Andrew Friedman some time to adapt to his new reality when he moved from Tampa to LA. Maybe the same is true for Stearns. I imagine that is an argument he has made to Cohen. However, like, the stakes are high, man. When they're putting this amount of money behind the team, I think it does change the way that I think about David Stearns. Like, I do think that he still deserves a chance to kind of fix his mess. But I think 2 years ago, I was like, this is a top three executive in the sport. And you have to be judged on what you've done. And he has done, you know, bupkis since then.
Yeah, it's just hard to know. I mean, even if they do sell, with how Peralta's pitching, how much of an opportunity is it really to like reload in any sort of meaningful way? And what this roster could look like next year around the few pillars that are there because you want them to be, like Soto and Lindor, that are there because maybe it didn't go as planned, like Bo Bichette. The state of the pitching staff is obviously quite delicate and quite disappointing.
Right.
But hey, man.
So,
I
like,
mean,
here's who they, could go. Here are the impending free agents, right? Bichette's got a $42 million player option. I'd be floored if he doesn't pick that up. Luis Robert has a club option at the end of the year. They could trade him now. Maybe. I just assume they'll let him walk in free agency. Clay Holmes has a $12 million player option that he almost certainly was going to decline until his leg exploded. And now I think that's probably 50-50, right? There's a chance he stays. There's a chance he goes. It depends on how his rehab goes. And then, like, the other impending free agents are Freddie Peralta, Brooks Raley, AJ Minter, Tyrone Taylor. So it's not as if they have a lot of enticing pieces to unload.
No, but I was going to say that the point that I was building up to, more about, all right, how aggressively are they going to be willing to just dump money? They did tell Frankie Montas, like, adios, dude. We'll pay you your $17 million and just go somewhere else. How many more of these guys are they going to be willing to do that with, right? I mean, are they willing to pay down all? Like, some team would trade for Sean Manaea if they barely have to pay him next season, you know? Polanco is much harder to say that because he really is just not available. Semien, it's like, how are you even going to move that?
$26 million Senga. For next year. Like, think about it this way. Senga, $14 million next year. Manaea, $25 million next year. Semien, $26 million next year. That is just...
Polanco.
I mean...
Polanco, 23. Like, I guess...
That is bad money. That is ugly,
so,
ugly
anyway,
money.
Now, all right. You mentioned, though, before. Let's get this out of the way. You mentioned two podcasts, not just one.
I did. Eric Chavez, former Mets hitting coach, Athletics third baseman, spilling the beans on his new podcast, EC3. Yeah, tap in with Eric Chavez. Chavez has not been shy about telling all regarding the discord between Francisco Lindor and Juan Soto and his own distaste for David Stearns. Some of this is true. Some of this is news. Some of this is interesting. Some of this is not. Lindor and Soto getting along more this year than they have in the past. Cohen just like straight up admitted that on his interview. Soto and Lindor not getting along last year is like not news. Maybe it is to some people. And if it is to you, I apologize. Like this has been written about. Good players don't get along all the time. Marcus Semien and Corey Seager didn't really get along. And guess what? They won a freaking World Series together. And it was okay. Right? This is not shocking to me. What is shocking to me, kind of, is that Eric Chavez is now just willing to spill all the beans. This tells me that Eric Chavez does not have interest in working in baseball again. I generally find this type of behavior to be self-serving. I believe, like, look, I'm a reporter. I'm not advocating for teams to, quote, keep things in-house. But you have to consider Eric Chavez's motives when he's going out here and telling these stories because he wants people to then listen to his podcast, which I understand as someone with a podcast. Maybe I should just start saying more things that I see around. Jordan, I heard that we hate each other, you know?
You'd have to start a different podcast and then you'd have to find someone else. Yeah, you'd have to find someone else. And I guess you could do this down the line.
I could.
If we ever, right? What you're going to have to find, though, and this is very key, and Eric Chavez isn't the first person to do this. You got to find someone that's going to just sit there and be like, yo, so true, man. That's crazy.
True, dude.
Wow. And so that's a big, you got to, because you can't just go on there and go solo monologue and just and dump it. You got to have someone on another mic saying, yo, for sure, man. That's totally
okay.
Great.
So is this interesting? Yes. But like, do I think it is relevant? No, I don't think particularly relevant. No. That the guy fired by David Stearns because, you know, The guy that David Stearns fired doesn't like David Stearns? What?
What?
I can't believe it.
Let me say this. I think that there is a more interesting conversation to be had about like the premise of former players starting their own podcasts, like craving that kind of interaction rather than just taking their money, going, sitting on the beach, or just going and being, or just like being a hitting coach anywhere without any sort of discord. Because when you're Eric Chavez or a lot of other people, you can just get those jobs pretty easily in baseball. But instead, he wants us to talk about him on Baseball Barbercast. And you succeeded, Eric Chavez. Congratulations.
I also should say, I do think there is an interesting conversation to be had about the Mets clubhouse and how it functions. And I do think that
but not because of
they
this.
Had too much. Yeah, like they had too much turnover coming into the season. I think that the issues that the Mets have had in gelling, no free ads, Dr. Schultz, are more to do with the ridiculous amount of turnover than it has to do with Lindor and Soto not getting along. And that is why I think that Eric Chavez is relatively unqualified to evaluate this current Mets team, because very few of them were there when Eric Chavez was there, because the whole story of this current Mets team is that it's completely different compared to 2025.
Right. And a lot of the stuff we've been already talking about, and there's plenty going on this year post Eric Chavez that is more interesting on its own
also, like,
than relitigating anything beforehand.
Juan Soto is not a vocal leader. That is not why they paid him all that money. Is an argument that a guy that makes that much money and is that important to a franchise should like have a little bit more feel? Yeah, maybe. His leadership comes in the form of hitting the baseball over the goddamn fence. I remember in college, you know, our coach, when we were struggling, used to be like, oh, someone show some leadership. And then a guy would hit a homer and we'd go, that's great leadership. Look at that guy leading that ball over the fence. You know, and that is Juan Soto's job. His job is not to hit the ball over, is not to be like a buddy. It's not to do rah-rah. That's not how like big league clubhouses work. And so I do understand that it is easy to kind of like throw shade at Soto. Oh, he's a lone wolf. Oh, he's operating by himself. And like, yeah, that can be an issue. And it has for him at times, and it has for other players all the time. But when your OPS starts with a 9, you can act like a big dog, because he is a big dog. Enough about Juan Soto, who will be at the All-Star game Let's go around the league. The All-Star rosters will be announced on Saturday night at 7:30 p.m., which is very inconvenient for anybody that works in baseball that wants to enjoy their July 4th. But who am I to complain? You people don't care about that. We do want to go over the most recent update just to kind of handicap where these All-Star races are at for you folks, because most of these in the final phase of voting are pretty much decided. The convoluted voting structure has led us to this, the end of the line here, where we have two candidates for all the positions and six candidates in the outfield. Jordan, can you hold my hand and take me through the National League?
Sure. So, right, we're just going to focus on the starters here with this update. Voting, I believe, did end officially last night, and they did give one more update telling us how the finalists were. Now, I'm much...
If you're in line, stay in line. If you're in line, stay.
No, if you're still in line and you're listening to this, you don't have to be in line anymore.
Get out of line. Why? If you're in line to vote for the All-Star game, why are you in line?
Where are you in line?
What line? What line?
First base, Freddie Freeman, a commanding lead over Matt Olson, 59-41. Second base, Ozzie Albies.
Quickly on Freddie. Quickly on Freddie.
Oh, yeah.
Freddie thing. Longest active All-Star streak in baseball. He has been at every single All-Star game dating back to 2018. That is the longest streak. Judge missed one in there. Trout missed one in there. Altuve missed one in there. Ramirez missed one in there. So Freddie, this will also be his 10th All-Star game, which is pretty cool. Chris Sale will both hit 10 this year.
Oh, okay. Ozzie Albies, speaking of the Braves, he is well ahead of Bryson Stott. It's very interesting to see like which ones the hometown guys ended up getting more support from versus the opposite. So Ozzie Albies, he's cruising at second base. Shortstop CJ Abrams, we were wondering if the Dodgers, even though Mookie Betts is obviously not having an All-Star season, if he would overtake CJ Abrams. It does not look like that'll be the case. CJ Abrams, a much-deserved starter. The Dodgers will have plenty of representation. Otherwise, we've mentioned Freeman, Max Muncy cruising over Alec Boehm as he should. I think the outfield is what's most interesting here, because the last update had Brandon Marsh at the top at 23%. So we expect him to be a starter. That's an awesome story. That's well-deserved. Juan Soto second. He's probably going to be the only Mets All-Star, I would imagine, and he deserves to be there as well. But then a very close
Carson Bench got a solid hit.
Carson, but yeah, why isn't he on here? But then a very close bench after that with Harris, Pajes, Acuna, Teoscar Hernandez. You know, some injuries involved there. We're going to talk about Michael Harris in a little bit for good, bad, ugly. But that's going to be close. So Marsh and Soto, though, we feel pretty good about. Oh, and I forgot to mention Drake Baldwin at catcher is he's running away with it over Will Smith. Now, that's a weird duo because Drake Baldwin has been awful since he returned from injury, and Will Smith is very injured and not going to be back anyway. So National League catcher, I'm curious. I mean, Baldwin's going to be there. I mean, it is what it is. He'll be the starter. I don't think that's a bad thing. But yeah, I imagine we'll have some other NL catchers there.
So just to review, the likely starting lineup here will be Freeman, Albies, CJ Abrams, Max Muncy, Drake Baldwin, Brandon Marsh, Juan Soto, and then either Michael Harris or Andy Pajes. Let's move over to the American League, where first base is hilarious as Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is beating Ben Rice by 10 percentage points, 55-45. Vlad, in the midst of the worst season of his life, he still does not have a home run at home. I love the idea that Blue Jays fans are still voting for him, even though they're angry that he is bad. It's like, figure it out, Vlad, but maybe figure it out at the All-Star game. If I was a Jays fan, I would not be voting for Vlad. I want this guy to go take a nap and like get in the cage.
Vote
and
for
not,
Ben Rice.
Like, fly to Philadelphia. Yeah. Vote for Jays fans. Vote for Ben Rice. It's not as if you're not going to have representation. Ernie Clement will be starting. You will have probably Dylan Cease there. Like, stop voting for Vlad. It is not in your best interest. Shortstop, Bobby Witt Jr. is smoking Andrés Giménez. They think this is the widest gap for any vote, as it should be. And Junior Caminero is going to be the starting third baseman. He has the commanding lead over Kazuma Okamoto at third. Yordan Alvarez will be the DH. He is beating another Blue Jay, George Springer, by a wide margin. And then Shea Langeliers will be the catcher. He is crushing Alejandro Kirk. So all these Blue Jays ended up getting like a ton of votes to go into the final two. And I would say none of them except for Okamoto deserve to be there. And they will all lose except for Vlad, which is so funny. The outfield is Mike Trout, Byron Buxton. Those two have a nice lead. They'll be in. Aaron Judge will probably be the third pick above Cody Bellinger and then Jesus Sanchez and Dalton Varsho. Go Blue Jays. Expect Judge to get in there, opt out, and then just give Bellinger that spot. That's what I'm expecting.
And then the biggest question is just Trout. He's been working his way back. I think he will be there and I think he will play. Maybe I can't guarantee that he will play. I just think that, especially with him being the leading vote getter here, having a good season before he got hurt, it being in Philly, I think Mike Trout will be there in some form, and it would be awesome if he is able to start. He could go to Jim's lunch.
He can go to Jim's lunch on the way to the game.
So there's your all-star. Now I'm way more interested in like everything that's not the starters, and we will have some content this weekend. I will have my all snub team coming out on Sunday, one of my favorite things I do every year, which also only lasts for a few days before we add 20 replacements due to injury and all these other guys pulling out. So, but we can get mad for a couple days for sure.
Team I'm most interested in is the Baltimore Orioles. I think they're the team that has the least clear deserving all-star. I think even the teams that are worse than the Orioles have a player that you look at them and you're like, that is an all-star. Like Hunter Goodman on the Rockies should be there, and Kevin McGonigal.
Bobby Witt,
Like Bobby Witt, you look at the Orioles and you're like, who's the all-star on this team? Probably on results it's Pete Alonso, but he's clearly behind like four other first basemen in the American League: Christian Walker, Wilson Contreras, Ben Rice, Nick Gertz, you know, I guess Vlad if he wins. And so it's like, okay, is it just going to be Rico Garcia? Gunner's been bad. Like the Orioles are the weirdest team, I think, for all-star for me.
Yeah, I was ready to make the Taylor Ward case, and he's like one for his last 25, so, and isn't hitting any home runs. So, I don't know, Orioles pretty bleak
David Rubenstein
in Baltimore.
To promote the book.
Put himself in there. That's true. Oh, Orioles. Oh, my goodness. All right, one more note before we take a break and then do the good, the bad, the ugly. I just wanted to kind of closure. Is closure the right word here? Not really.
No.
But
wrap
up
the story.
Some amount of resolution. Although I guess they could still appeal. We have suspensions from the Red Sox Nationals. Cade Cavalli versus Wilson Contreras. 7 games for both of them. It sounds like the Contreras suspension was not only for his actions on the field, but also immediately going on Instagram and commenting during a game to a fan to tell him to come meet him at Fenway. So that sounds like that was probably not the move for Wilson Contreras to do that.
Listen, kids.
Miles Michaelis.
Kids.
And Nate Eaton also.
If you ever get ejected from a game, kids, listen, kids. And you go to the clubhouse and you go on your phone and you go on Instagram and someone says something mean to you, don't tell them to, don't respond. You could go to your notes app and type up what you would say and then put your phone away. That's what I would do. That's my strategy. Write a note. Write a letter. Wilson Contreras should have written a letter. 5 games for Miles Michaelis and 3 games for Nate Eaton. The thing to understand here, it at first glance, it's like this feels uneven. Why are the suspensions the same number of games? Pitchers don't play every day. So what this really is a one outing suspension for Cavalli and a 7-game suspension for Contreras, a one outing suspension for Michaelis, right? And so I think that is like a good way to think about it. We also had statements from Cade Cavalli and Paul Toboni, president of the Nationals baseball operations, who had I thought they gave pretty good statements about Cavalli's use of the word boy in this context. Cavalli expressed legitimate contrition. He was very direct, and I thought offered like a, you know, about as good of an apology as like you would usually expect from a baseball player in this type of circumstance.
Yes. Yeah. It sounds like there was pretty explicit communication internally that resulted in as productive of a response as you could hope for.
My understanding is that a conversation was had in a good way. And so we'll see how that happens moving forward. I think that Cade Cavalli deserves both a level of criticism here, and also I don't think this is the type of thing that should damn him as a human being for the rest of his life.
Yep, I think that that is fair. All right, let's take a break. When we return, oh boy, the World Cup baseball crossovers continue. We'll be back
with the good,
the bad, the ugly. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbecue.
And welcome back to the End of Baseball Barbecast. I'm Jake Mintz. Believe it or not, that's Jordan Schusterman. And we're going to do a segment that we quite enjoy called The Good, The Bad, and The Agua. One thing good, one thing bad, one thing reminiscent of Dan Ugla from the week that was Jordan Schusterman. The floor is yours.
Dansby Swanson's having a pretty good few weeks. My goodness, this is a heater of a lifetime. As Dansby Swanson had a 3-home run game on Wednesday against the Padres, following up his 2-home run game on Tuesday against the Padres. This coming just a week and a half after he had an 11 RBI doubleheader against the Mets. It was just 2 weeks ago that Dansby Swanson had a 587 OPS. He was one of the worst hitters in baseball. He was playing every day. He was playing great defense. He was running the bases on the rare occasion he was reaching base. But this dude was not hitting. And now suddenly, at this more than halfway into the season, he has managed to raise his OPS more than 100 points. I did not think this was mathematically possible when you've played this much baseball already. But here he is. The most incredible part about this hot streak is that within here, there was also like an 0 for 16 with a bunch of strikeouts. So crazy hot against the Blue Jays and Mets, goes cold against the Brewers. That's unfortunate timing. But then heats back up against the woeful Padres, who are not playing good baseball right now. 29 RBIs in, what is this, like 10 games? I don't even know. Almost 10 games? Less than 10 games? 15 games? Dansby Swanson's making RBI cool, which I appreciate. I think RBIs can be cool when you have stats like this. And I think this is a great example of it. And I'm happy for Dansby Swanson. We like Dansby. We know that he is capable of being a good hitter. But it hasn't been the case this year. And now he's getting it all back at once, which is really impressive. And the Cubs are in fuego.
Yep. He is being those R's eye. My good this week is one of Dansby's former teammates, Michael Harris. And there's only one.
Ooh.
Michael Harris. One of the most enjoyable unforeseen stories of this baseball season has been World Cup crossover. The international fans in these major cities having nothing to do between the various soccer games of their teams, and therefore heading to the ball yard to spend some joyous time, to drink a handful of libations, and to let loose around a sport that they know absolutely nothing about. We had the Scots taking over Fenway Park. We had the Scots taking over Lone Depot. And yesterday, we had the Brits fresh off, not yesterday, a couple days ago, fresh off their victory over Dr. Congo. Comeback W. Thanks to Sir Harry Kane, going to the Braves game and adopting Michael Harris as their favorite player, chanting at the Braves center fielder all game long. There's only one Michael Harris. There's only one Michael Harris. My favorite tweet that I saw was from someone named Lloyd Canfield, who I believe was there or is maybe an aggregator. Just the way that the Brits talk about baseball. England fans have chosen a random baseball player, Michael Harris of the Atlanta Braves, to support more than anyone else at the baseball. after beating DR Congo, and it's absolutely class. At the baseball. We're going to the baseball. Like, in over there, they say, oh, we're going to the football. You going to the football on Saturday? You going to see the football? We have to start doing this, Drew. This is so good. What are you going to... Are you going to the baseball? Yes, of course I'm going to the baseball.
Often.
The best part of this, the best part of this for me is that Michael Harris did very little in this game. I believe he went 0 for 4. He made a couple catches. The crowd loved it anyway. And then after the game, Mike Harris went out there with his freaking phone and recorded a selfie with the fans. Like, beautiful. I'm happy the Braves won, so he was able to do that. And that made it better. I don't think this will be our final ball, kicky, round the bases crossover. If you're listening to this and you are Iberian, if you're from that lovely peninsula over there in Europe and you're in Dallas, boot up the Game Time app, okay? Head over to the Rangers against the Tigers on Sunday. Portugal versus Spain on Monday at the football yard in Arlington. You got to do something on Sunday. Okay. Iberia, I need you there. Game Time app, buy your tickets, show up, cheer on your favorite player, Mackenzie Gore or Josh Smith, however you want to say it. Roll those R's and let loose watching the baseball. Hey,
Casey Mize against Cal Quantrill. So,
Casey Mize. Oh my God, it's Casey Mize.
I just have to say before we go to
Vicky Casey Barcelona.
All of the Michael Harris chants are great. All the chants we've had, we had some chants about some Marlins and, you know, the Scots.
Yeah.
These soccer chants are great. However, there's only one Michael Harris for the second. Well, no, he's literally Michael Harris the second. I'm not just talking about the fact that there are other people named Michael Harris.
He's one of two Michael Harrises. His dad's Michael Harris.
We love Michael Harris. All the Michael Harris.
There's two.
It was great stuff. So I'm glad that Michael Harris played along. I'm not surprised. All right, let's go to bat. Speaking of England. The Royals suck. Hey.
Whoa. Sorry. That's an ongoing conversation in British society. Okay. Right. Some people are pro, some against.
I'll keep it focused.
Some of the Royals definitely suck. That I feel okay saying.
And even if we ignore the reference to the ones across the pond, the ones that I am talking about, the Kansas City Royals. I mean, just straight yikes, folks. I don't really know how else to say it. They are now tied with the Rockies for the worst record in baseball. They are only the Rockies have a worse run differential. They're chilling at a cool minus 83. And this is just a disaster of a season. And it hasn't even really been that interesting because they've just been injured and like normal bad. Their stats aren't even, yes, the record and the run differential, but it's not like they're 30th in every category the way we've seen with like the Rockies and the White Sox. No, they're just losing and losing and losing and losing. They were swept at home by the Rays. That was the seventh time they were swept this season. No other team has been swept more often. And it just sucks. There's a lot of people on this team that we like. But I don't know. I don't know where this team goes from here, man. I got to be honest. This was a team that coming into the season had the second best playoff odds in the American League Central behind Detroit. And
what about now?
Well, I talked plenty about Detroit, but Detroit is still in a bad place, but they have a chance. The Royals, it's over. You're really bad. And I don't know who they're going to trade away, but just a really bad baseball team, bad season. And bad. Welcome to bad.
Call it the tennis court oath because it's over for the Royals. That's for all my French Revolution heads out there. My bad this week is Roky Sasaki, who didn't cry. I was wrong. He didn't cry last start. Maybe he should. today because he got clobbered last night against San Diego Padres, allowing six earned in three innings. And because the Dodgers, they came all the way back and they beat the Padres. They're 13 games up on them now. What a hilarious situation. But Roky was, I mean, he was ass last. Like, he was totally awful last night. Also bad for me thinking that he cried. I shouldn't assume that people are crying. That's not cool. Roky had a very hilarious quote where he was just like, yeah, people think I'm crying. This is from Chad Moriyama, put it on Twitter. Quote, I'm not going to cry. I was told that was the case last year, but I never cried on the bench or on the ground. I saw the topic on the internet, but I hope you don't mind. First of all, that is the face. His face is red, so it looks like it. I was certainly worried and I was frustrated, but I didn't cry. So he's just got resting cry face, I guess. Which,
yeah,
bad attribute for a professional athlete to have resting cry face. Whether or not Roky's crying actually doesn't matter to me because it looks like he's crying, and a guy that looks like he's crying while he's doing poorly only contributes to the narrative. The ups and downs of Roky Sasaki, it is a roller coaster that I do not want to be on anymore. I'm sure I will get back on when it reaches the top. I think Roky could actually use a good cry. Roky, pour yourself a glass of wine, turn on some sad sounds, and just zone out and let loose, man. Everyone could use a good cry every once in a while.
And he's like, oh, we're chilling. We're 13 games up. Yesterday or whatever, it was like, oh, Padres, Dodgers, four games. Let's go. And then it was like, who cares? 13 games. What a joke. They're now tied with the, they're now down to 500. They're tied with the D-backs in second/third yeah. place. And I mean, credit to the Dodgers, but not awesome.
Cry.
San Diego.
Cry.
Yeah, they should be crying too. All right, let's go to Ugla.
Everyone should cry.
How about you? You go Ugla first before I finish okay. this off.
This is very quick. Here's a sentence that's true. The Baltimore Orioles and the Washington Nationals made a trade for the first time ever. How?
Sway.
The Nationals who have been around since 2005. Possible? Been around since 2005. The how is that possible is probably has something to do with the Masson dispute between these two teams over the television rights and just having a really bad relationship with one another. And now that they're under new leadership in DC and new ownership in Baltimore and the Masson stuff is resolved, is probably why this happens now. The trade itself, blockbuster. What's the opposite of a blockbuster? A Netflix. For the first time in their respective histories, this is from Mark Zuckerman, Big Zuck. The Nats and O's have made a trade. Right-handed pitcher Kyle Nicklaus comes to the Nats, an option to AAA. Minor league infielder Randall Diaz goes to the O's. The Nats are going for it. This is just very funny that these two teams never traded, considering I think they're the close. So, like, if we're going by, like, proximity of two stadiums, number one, I think is, I would guess, is New York. Number two
has to be New York.
Is probably yeah. Chicago. This is probably number three.
Is it possible that they're closer than Chicago? I'm not sure. That might be a very stupid no. geography.
That is a bad question. That is a bad. It's a bad take.
Okay.
Open a map one time. Anyway, O's and Nats made a trade maps first time ever. Amazing.
For those wondering,
we do love maps. It, look. If you ever yeah. see us in a press box, 50% chance that one of us is just on Google Maps zooming in on a street. Like, that's just what we sure. love to do. That's my hobby. That's, like, one of my favorite things to do in my free time.
Shout out, Rainbolt. For those wondering, the Orioles yep. and Expos have made a trade. I say have as if, like, they're still in existence.
They'll make
Jorge
another.
Jorge Julio for Ryan Minor. December 22nd.
Ryan Minor... RIP, very important. He's the one who came in for Cal Ripken at the end of the streak.
Correct. He was also on the most recent University of Oklahoma national championship team before they just won it this year. So, shouts out to Ryan Minor. All right,
are you thirsty? You're looking a little thirsty.
A little thirsty? Excuse me? Big. This is big time thirst. All right?
Mm.
Big time thirst, big time taste. Let's talk about a commercial from 2018 involving sure. still free agent LeBron James. Now, it's possible LeBron has decided to, you know, sign with the some G League team, or maybe he's going to go play in Turkey. By the time you're listening to this, or he's coming home to the Cavs, going to the Heat, going to the Warriors, going to the Nuggets, who knows? I thought he would have decided by then, by now. I can't believe I'm saying this. I got to give Bill Simmons some credit here. I was one of the bajillion people listening to Bill Simmons' reaction to the Jaylen Brown trade. And he brought up the idea, and this, bringing this back to baseball, we'll talk about Big Taste in a second, that what LeBron should do is just pull a Roger Clemens and not sign and just wait to find out who's good and just show up in February, which is kind of genius. Like, why wouldn't he do that? But anyway, the other thing LeBron James has in common with Roger Clemens is that his mound presence is unparalleled.
Superb.
And we know that because of this commercial from 2018, which LeBron did for this beverage company. And there's so much in this 1 minute clip. I believe there's a 30 second version, but we'll focus on the 1 minute clip that we could go for an hour. But in rewatching this, you did this as our intro earlier this week. I assume you've rewatched it a few times since then. Just what are your favorite parts? Because it is just there. If you haven't seen it, it involves LeBron James coming in as a closer to strike out Thirst. And he throws a ice cold.
It's a Sprite commercial. You could say Sprite.
It's a Sprite commercial. And he throws it past the batter, and the umpire says, "Be right," like Sprite, strike, strike three. What's funny about that is that it's not a called strike or a called Sprite. It's a swinging.
Swinging Sprite.
It's a swinging Sprite. And so the way it's filmed makes it look like it was a called strike three, and the crowd waits to react. It's like, well, no, if he swings and misses,
it's
a Sprite.
Did he go?
It's a Sprite. No, you also, went. No check swing it's ambiguity just one pitch. Here.
It's just one pitch, it's right?
True.
And so it's as if LeBron was called in with a two strike count.
One of my favorite
things about this commercial is that the way that the coach calls the bullpen to ask for LeBron to come in is he doesn't say anything except for Big Taste. He doesn't say, bring in Big Taste. He doesn't go out to the mound to pull the previous pitcher.
No.
Which is the thing that happens. LeBron just walks, or excuse me, Mr. Taste comes out from the pen by himself wearing a jersey that says Big Taste with 12 ounces as the number. Toes the rubber. The hitter is Thirst wearing number 99. The catcher, the most notable thing about the catcher, Jordan, is not that it's a woman who presumably made baseball history at some point. Earlier on in this timeline, she's one of many, is that the catcher, two knees up, very old school. You know, everyone now is going one knee down with the stance. She's got two knees up, and I guess you could say she's got a glass of ice in her throwing hand.
Yes. Well, because she's waiting for the Sprite. She's waiting to catch the Sprite.
She's waiting for the Sprite. The thing, though, she catches the Sprite. She's going to have to crack that thing open, but she doesn't have the hands to do it. She's going to have to take the glove off. Like, it's going to be a whole thing.
But this is the funniest part about this. You're totally correct. You're saying old school, but I don't blame her. This is 2018. Even in 2018, one knee down was basically non-existent. I mean, it's actually completely up to time.
Could you imagine if this catcher in this fictional commercial was one knee down? Like Tanner Swanson, who like helped come up with the one knee down thing as a Yankees catcher coach, like called Sprite and was like, get a one knee. It's way more effective for framing. It's like, oh, for Sprite 3?
My favorite thing about, I mean, there's so much more, but we'll cut it off here. The shot, which is kind of like a side angle of LeBron delivering the pitch. This image has just stuck with me for so long, right?
Absolutely.
We have a long lineage of athletes doing terrible first pitches, but this is such an interesting one because it's a fictional version. It does seem like he is the one delivering it. We don't really see where it goes, but we have this side profile of LeBron's delivery, And I just think about it all the time, particularly he's not getting into his legs pitchers.
At all.
He's not the lack of extension here is downright shocking.
It's embarrassing.
If you pause it when he first like picks the leg up, it actually looks all right. But then it's just
the glove
so
is
upright.
So big.
The glove is huge. It's also icy cold, of course. But when you just look at foot strike, it's just like, dude, you are 6'9". Like, let's get down the mound, big fella.
And call Glass now.
He just has no idea how to use his body there. So the point is if we're going with fictional LeBron James commercial athletes, he probably would have been best off being a tight end for the Browns like he was in that commercial even longer ago.
Jordan.
I'm so glad this commercial exists. It makes me so happy. I look forward to watching it 100 more times after we get off.
Can I offer you just one more freeze frame for your consideration? Please freeze it when the hitter swings. Like, as the bat goes through the zone, this hitter who is not wearing cleats is wearing flats. This hitter whose legs are effectively just, like, together. It is really... This is a wonderful commercial. It is so good. There's nothing wrong about it. And you know what? I'm going to go buy a Sprite today. I'm going to go get a Sprite.
It worked.
I don't even like Sprite, but Sprite deserves my money, dude, for making this commercial. If you're listening, honestly, go buy a Sprite today.
I was also just thinking about this because the other premise of this commercial is that it is disgustingly hot and uncomfortable. And that was me at the ballpark all week. I mean, it has been absolutely disgusting.
I've needed to strike out thirst.
I did. Also, by the way, I looked up. This guy, the batter, who's an actor who's played some bit roles here and there, was on the University of Nebraska football team that won back-to-back national titles in the 90s.
So, all right, time to go.
Shouts out to that guy. All right, we're done. Thank you all for listening to this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Enjoy the baseball this weekend. Enjoy the fireworks. Enjoy whatever level of patriotism you would like to express. Understandable in any direction.
Let me say something. Mm-hmm. America is turning 250 years old tomorrow, and baseball has been around for over half of that time. And I was thinking about that this morning, and that is a remarkable thing. Is baseball the most popular sport in our country? Certainly not. Is it the most relevant sport right now with the World Cup going on? Certainly not. But it is America's pastime. It has been a reflection, a mirror, a distraction, an inspiration. And I think in these turbulent times, I think baseball is an example that people with differing viewpoints can join together to achieve a common goal. Now, that common goal in the case of a clubhouse is winning. And that is much easier, right? Because people are making a lot of money. But I do think that our sport is a small but essential piece of our nation's story. And I would like to just share a message of hope and optimism and promise as we tumble forward in this American experiment with baseball at its core. I feel, as someone that is dedicated their life to covering the sport, you have to understand America to do that. And so I just wish everybody a meaningful July 4th. And I hope we're all around for 300.
I hope that you celebrate it by ignoring your family and watching Marlins, A's, or Giants.
USA!
Rockies.
USA!
Thank you for
rooting against the Jays.
Barbecast.
Who are the Jays playing? Who are the Jays playing this weekend? They got the Mariners? Yeah, the Mariners?
They
go
got
to the Mariners?
Mariners.
Boo the Jays. Okay?
Well, and like Seattle right now is Team USA Central. So it's actually appropriate that Toronto's coming to town. I know, you know, Canada's still, they're playing tomorrow, right? So we'll see how they're feeling. Thank you to Andrew Hartz. Thank you to Ingrid Roses. Ingrid back. Shout out Ingrid for producing this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Email us, baseballbarbacast@gmail.com.
Yep.
And we will be back on Monday.
Bad weekend to be a beer.